This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. As a 10-year-old girl, Jane Smith Patterson lost her father to a heart attack. But before he died, he told her something that started her on a mission to make her own way in the world, no matter what the circumstances. At 16, she left her hometown to go to college. She later became the first female chair of a county Democratic Party in North Carolina and worked with Governor Jim Hunt's cabinet through his 4 terms in office. She has met with Gloria Steinem and personally advised Jimmy Carter. And throughout all of this, she was also a technology pioneer, helping to boost digital access in cities and rural areas all around the states, this state of North Carolina. And she joins us today to tell us more. Jane Smith Patterson, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So what was it that your father told you?
My father told me, and this happened as a result of watching the Ku Klux Klan go down the front road in front of my home with their crosses burning, that always remember, Jane, it's not the shape or the color of your skin that is important. It's what's inside of you and what you plan to do to make the world a better place.
And this was had to be before you were 10 years old.
Right? I was 10.
You were 10. This had to have an impact because you were born in Columbus County.
Born actually in Wilmington in the hospital, but there grew up in Columbus County.
So tell us about that. I mean, if the Klan is making parades down your street, it must have been pretty hospitable territory for them. Eh?
Well, they actually came over the line from South Carolina. We're right on the border. And as a result of a person who wasn't necessarily liberal, he was pretty conservative, but the editor of the newspaper there, Horace Carter, actually would editorialize against the Klan and what they were trying to do. And so they actually were able to, I believe, find the Klan guilty there. And I don't know, close to 100, I think, went to jail.
What was it like growing up there when you did in the 1940s?
Well, it was, you know, wonderful families around me. Our street, the mayor lived on our street. The principal of the school lived on our street. The chairman of the school board lived on our street. So it was a small town, and everyone took responsibility that I knew for everyone else. And so when my dad died, I had, as Mrs. Clinton would say, a village to raise children. And all of my neighbors pitched in and were fantastic. My mother was an incredible human being. And, you know, we all made it out of there. Education was considered the most important thing, Frank. It was talked about every day by my mother and all of my siblings' parents.
Critical to a good education is a good principal, and you led the campaign to keep your principal from being moved out in high school.
Yeah, he was a wonderful person and very tough, and you know, in terms of you have to keep your nose clean, you have to also do your homework and come to school, and I will help you get into college. That's what he would say. And so we all were somewhat scared of him, although he lived on my street and he didn't frighten me that much. But as a result, the school board, which was named at that time, Frank, by the state senator from our district, who was the brother of the doctor who lived across the street from me. He also named, I think, the deputy sheriffs and the sheriffs. It was quite a county, very similar to Madison County in the West. And so they decided that he'd been there too long. He'd been there 19 years. And we asked to speak to him. We were students in high school and asked to speak with him. And with Dr. Williamson, the head of the school board, and he refused. And so I came home and said to my mom, hey, you know, this isn't right. It's not democracy when they won't even let the students talk to the school board. And my mother said, well, she had been a school teacher at one time. And as you know, with women, and we'll talk about that later, she had her contract not renewed when she got engaged. Okay, so we can talk about that later. But anyway, Dr. Williamson wouldn't speak to us, and I said, well, we have to do something about this. So a number of the parents agreed with us, and my dad had asked that I be given his Masonic ring. And so I had that Masonic ring, and I knew they're supposed to help you out. So I went to the Masons and said, can we use the log hut here? And it's across from the school, big, very large facility. And they said, yep, and we'll give you some food. So we talked to the students. We taught our classes there. We left the high school. The high school's about 400 students. Only one stayed in the high school, and she was the daughter of a teacher, and we didn't want her mother to lose her job. And so
We
walked out.
For how long?
We walked probably a couple of days.
Wow.
We said we would go back in if they would speak with us. So finally they agreed to let us talk. And we went back into school. And they kept him, I think, about till I graduated from high school.
Which is why they threw you out by the time you left when you were 16. I do want to know what it was your mother said to you when you were about to lead this campaign. You're a woman. It's somewhere in the 1940s. And you're about to take on state senator.
This would have been about the 50s.
Okay.
In about 52, 53, okay. Somewhere, yeah. 54, I guess. She thought that we should speak up for what we believed in. My mom believed in that. Yeah. And when I was involved with civil rights, my mother talked at that time to the judge, who was the judge over cases here in Orange County, and said, I know Jane and Hank are involved in all this. I'd like to have her home for Christmas. Bail her out if you would, and so she can come home. So mom was very willing to support us if she thought we had come to a decision based on good facts.
You did go to college. We've been saying 15. You had 16, just turned 16 when you went to college.
So
tell us about that. Where'd you go, and how is it that you got there so early?
Well, I'd skipped grade. I was in the first grade, and I think I remember reading 65 books in the first grade. And my dad had taught me to read when I was just turning 4, and on a newspaper, on the News Observer. And so I really wanted to stay in the grade I was in. They wanted to skip me, but they tested me and still told Mother I should leave the grade. So I got in the principal's wife's class, and she called my mom and said, you know, Jane, she's just so far ahead of these folks. She goes and tries to help everyone. They're not learning because she's helping them. And so Mother said, well, test her again. So they tested me again, and I scored like 12th grade reading ability in the second grade. And they said, well, we're going to skip her to the third grade, and which is what they did at Christmas. And I remember that the teacher I had, Miss Hicks, who lived 2 doors down the street, I just like kids at that age, I really felt like my friends felt like I was leaving them, and the ones in my sister's grade felt that I was too young. So I skipped. But then my friends were much older.
Mm-hmm.
I would have friends who were in the 5th, 6th, 7th grades. And when they talked about me skipping again, I remember running away and hiding under stairs because I just didn't want to skip another grade.
Too bad you didn't have that Mason ring then. You could have started your own school.
Yeah.
So later you went to women's college, which is now UNCG.
I went to women's college because my mom had gone there. And she felt that women would become better leaders if they were competitive with each other because, you know, we weren't admitted at that time to Chapel Hill. Mm. It wasn't until the late 60s till you could be admitted as a woman to Chapel Hill. So I went to school at Women's College. And once before I enrolled, we got a letter at home which said that they would be admitting I think it said black students, not African-American students, to the class. And, did I mind rooming in the dorm or whatever? And I said, no. And I wrote back and said, I'm colored. I'm white. And so I don't have a problem with rooming in the same dormitory. And there were 2 students in my class. And then when I got to Chapel Hill, I was in a class. Obviously, when I transferred, they had the first African-American students graduate from Chapel Hill, from the university.
And what was the status of women? So there were 2 African-American students, the first 2 to go to women's college, and you roomed with one and knew the other.
Well, I didn't room with them. They were on the same hall.
Hall. So then when you went to UNC, you did transfer to mm-hmm. Chapel Hill. What was the situation like for women on that campus at the time?
Well, situation for women on campus, both at Women's College and at UNC, if you were coming from a high school and as involved as I was with basketball and drama and music and arts and, and coming in at 2 in the morning, you had to be in your dorm room at 11 o'clock. You had to leave the library at 10:30. You had to sign in to walk across campus. On Friday nights and Saturday nights, you had the right to stay out till 12 on Saturday. And I think it was 1 on Saturday, Sunday, and then back on Sunday. And back on Sunday, it's back at 12 o'clock. So you had real problems. You could not wear Bermudas. You weren't really supposed to wear slacks on campus unless you had a raincoat over it. It was just unbelievable for someone who had, even growing up in a small town where, you were much freer than you were there.
So you're sort of in the vanguard. You're on this advanced wave of both for women and in some ways for African Americans being in that first group of integrated classes. And you also helped to integrate the Carolina Theater, right?
Yes, and at Women's College. I remember, and this is important, I think, I remember that one of my friends, we decided to go down to Tate Street to go to the movie theater. And I had recalled the movie theaters in the town I grew up in. And back then, when kids, if people came to get their tickets, they'd have a ticket for a counter to take up for white people and one for African Americans and Indians. And cowboy and Indian movies were wild because it was really funny. Different people taking different sides, screaming for the cowboys and the Indians. But you know, at Tate Street, we were. I think I'm not sure what happened. We got in.
This is in Greensboro.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But when we went back a couple of days later and told people that you could now, it was integrated, they blocked people from going in. Mm-hmm. And so we were told that we couldn't wear our jackets, our blazers that had WUNC on them. We could go there and wear regular clothes, but not show we were from the university. So when I got to Chapel Hill and got involved in the YMYWCA, I found that the students, that the university did not recruit African-American students to come to the university. So those of us who were involved in student government would leave and go out and recruit at black high schools to get them to come to Chapel Hill.
I'm talking with Jane Smith Patterson, who's devoted a life to changing the landscape for women and technology in North Carolina. And we will have more of that conversation on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio talking with Jane Smith Patterson, who runs an organization that promotes high-speed internet in rural areas around the state. We're going to talk about how she got there, and it began really as a political activist, and we were talking about integrating theaters and your efforts to also promote education in places where it had been shut down. You went to Farmville, Virginia. That was a famous, infamous place.
Yes, Farmville was... North Carolina, at the time that Brown versus the Board of Education actually was passed, I guess, in 54, North Carolina was the only southern state that elected not to do mass disobeying of the federal law. And so North Carolina started classes integrating from first grade all the way up. In Virginia, basically, in many areas, they shut – it's a commonwealth and very different from North Carolina. They shut the schools down. And in Prince Edward County predominantly, the white kids began to go to these churches, I guess, their own charter schools.
Right.
Bob Kennedy called and asked if we
could
get some.
And who's Bob Kennedy?
He was going to be hopefully the president of the United States, but at that time, I guess.
Oh, that
he
Bob
was,
Kennedy.
Yeah, that Bob Kennedy.
Robert Kennedy.
He called us and said, my husband and I have been involved in helping write the charter of the Peace Corps. And so he knew us from the. My future husband and I, who knew us from the meetings with Sergeant Shriver, and asked that we go into Prince Edward County and ask the Y at Chapel Hill and to teach on weekends because the kids there had no, black kids had no schools. So we went up there and taught on the weekends.
Yeah, they
it
said.
It was quite a shock to us. I mean, even the ministers and the doctors and the dentists got together and fed us, and they were frightened that we were there. It was really. North Carolina was very different from Virginia, even at that time.
Massive resistance, it was called. And, yeah, shut down the schools, created essentially private schools for white mm-hmm. kids. And then they said, you may have your own. And, of course, there were none. Well, how did you come to the attention of the likes of Robert Kennedy?
My husband, I was at Chapel Hill. I met my husband as a result of the efforts on civil rights, actually. And he and I wanted to try to see how we could make the South change and build a new South. So we went to work to bring two students from every college in the South together to talk about building a new South. And we got money, $25,000 from the Field Foundation in Chicago at that time. My first touch with philanthropy coming from there. And we actually ran a thing on a whole week on the how we would build a new South. And at that time, also, the Peace Corps was being, and we had worked with Sergeant Shriver. And then I had been involved back and forth, and actually, just to cut quickly, I would have run a part of the campaign for Bob Kennedy when he was killed before that happened. And I think you know, people say John Kennedy's your hero. Bob Kennedy's my hero. I think he was an incredible person who cared about the common person, the person trying to work their way up in a society. And so he knew a lot about Chapel Hill, I mean, and all of the students who'd been involved in the National Student Association. And my husband was an officer of that, not officer. He was a person who was selected to run a program for students coming from around the world. It was Bob Kennedy's idea. We didn't know it at the time. It was actually funded by the CIA, which we didn't know at the time. And later the Washington Post revealed that story. And we at Chapel Hill had had two presidents of USNSA, Dick Murphy and Al Lowenstein. And so Bob Kennedy knew a lot about us.
It's an interesting time in American history. John Kennedy, of course, is his older brother. The idea of white privilege had been unchallenged until this moment in American history, or in any serious way. And so for people of that generation, it's really about consciousness building. And you're right on that threshold, and as we said, kind of in the advance guard. You go back to your father, I guess, that advice he gave you on the porch when the Klan was walking by. What kind of support were you getting for this? What were the people back in your hometown saying now that Jane's getting kind of uppity?
Well, it wasn't only my hometown. Later, it was my husband's family here in Chapel Hill. They were town Chapel Hill. They weren't university Chapel Hill. And they would say things to us like, "We'd really like to have you out at the farm to come out for September Labor Day. We know you're communist, but we'd love to, your family, we'd love to have you out." Well, I say, "What's communist?" "Well, you're for integration."
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, it was, my hometown never taught me to hate, Frank. I was never taught, never thought about religious prejudice. The Jewish families in my hometown, we all dated each other. The one thing in my hometown that was different, the Catholic Church was 10 by 10. So Catholics, we back then had Hate Catholic Sunday, which the Baptists would have every quarter, a Hate Catholic Sunday. And my mom would come home and say, "All religions are good." She would teach us that there was differences in religions, that we should respect that. So that came from my mother as well, because her family were Methodist, but anyway.
You actually met your husband at a sit-in, is that right?
Yeah, the one between Chapel Hill and Durham. The Howard Johnsons. And students at Chapel Hill decided to, we knew that Bobby Baker and that Lyndon Johnson's, who was Lyndon Johnson's key person, and also that B. Everett Jordan, the state senator, and Luther Hodges, the Secretary of Commerce, owned it. And we figured if we could break that open, that would be easy to do, because John Kennedy wasn't going to let the Secretary of Commerce remain the Secretary of Commerce if that was the case. And so McKissick and folks from North Carolina Central, McKissick head of CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, and some Duke students all got together and went over. And the sheriff would come out and tell people to leave, and, people would walk out and go back in. But it wasn't long till that was opened.
At this point, you're still on the fringe of the political system, a little bit on the outside looking in. Eventually, you volunteered for Jim Hunt. Tell us what happened there and why you decided to do that.
Well, there were a lot of us. I think if you go back and look at the 60s, you'll find a lot of us who are very close in North Carolina at the way we thought the state needed to move forward. And they weren't just at Chapel Hill. There were some at State, Duke, Wake Forest, and, other schools around the state as well. And so we knew Jim Hunt from his being president of the student body at Chapel Hill. North Carolina State University. Mm-hmm. And he was in Nepal at the time and working as a Ford Foundation economic advisor. And he was coming back. And so some of us said, this guy could really help pull this state ahead. And we got together. And one of the people that was there was Joe Grimsley, who was a graduate of Chapel Hill. And actually, this tells you how much committed I think we were. Joe was the only one that had any assets at the time. So he sold the house in Oriental that he had put his money in from being in the Peace Corps and gave that up to run Jim Hunt's campaign. And so I don't think none of us took salaries. I mean, we worked, I'd travel from Greensboro and work. Others travel from other places because we thought he gave us the greatest opportunity to help North Carolina in education and in economic development, and that he was a person of the future. He saw what my dad saw, that it wasn't the shape or the color of your skin that mattered.
His heart and mind may have been there, but occasionally he needed a little push to take things a little farther. You helped him write new rules for the Democratic
Party.
Well,
yeah, he wrote in 68, there had been a massive uproar in Chicago at the convention, and Jim Hunt was there, and everybody saw, I think, his leadership capability, and they named him to the O'Hara Commission. And so he wanted to make sure he wrote the first, the state that got the first rewrite of their laws was North Carolina on the Democratic rules. And so he drafted them, and I remember looking at him and saying, calling him down in Wilson, Lucama, in Rock Ridge, and saying, "Jim, it doesn't say anything in here about women." I said, "It says, you know, all the things are important, like religion and, you know, all this stuff, but it doesn't say anything about women." So he said, "All right, I'll put it in there." And I said, "Well, if you don't, I'm going to challenge you the next morning on the floor." And I knew I think I could win it.
The floor of the convention.
Yeah.
This is going on.
This is in North Carolina. Yeah. And so he said, "Oh, Jane, you know I'll put that in there. I just forgot it." So he put it in. And it passed.
Eventually, you were the first – is this true? The first chairperson of a Democratic county?
Urban county. Urban county in the state. I'm not sure about other rural counties, but the urban counties had no women in positions like that, except an appointment of Louise Brennan in Charlotte, a wonderful woman. And so I ran against the establishment candidate, who was one of the big law firms in the state. At that time, Smith, Moore, Smith, Shell, and Hunter, and ran against this guy. And they would attack me in the paper as a housewife politician. And, and I finally went down to the paper. And this is how bad it was. I went down to the newspaper and said, "The guy running on the Republican side over here is a plumber. Is he a plumber politician? And this person running is a lawyer. Are they a lawyer politician?" So they dropped the moniker of housewife politician. And so I won and was, you know, chairman of the party. And we began to do a lot of really try to encourage more women to run in the county. And
it's Guilford County.
Guilford County.
So how do you do that? So it's one thing to say, okay, we will not discriminate on the basis of race, religion, and gender, and you get that put in. But that's in the rules. How do you actually encourage people to change roles, to get out of the old role and see themselves in new ways, politically active?
Well, in the county, in Guilford, the way we did it was we began to invite everybody to come to the meetings, those who represented, the middle-of-the-road Democrats, those who represented liberals, conservatives. We invited all kinds of ethnic backgrounds and women, and we would meet on Saturday mornings and talk about the issues in the county and have breakfast and get to know each other. And I'll give you an example of what that did for Guilford County. We were able to elect, I think we were able to elect most Democrats at that point. Many Republicans held office in the county. We were able to reverse that trend, and we were able to get people who were, lower income, white, African Americans, to understand they had exactly the same issues that they were concerned with. And I remember when I left to join Governor Hunt in 76, in 77, I was called to go out to a little rural community called Whitsitt by a couple who had been Wallace supporters. And they wanted me to come and have breakfast. So I went out with Braxton, my youngest son, and we went to their house. And it was an old house with a stump that you stood on to go inside. And they were just the salt of the earth people. And we went inside and ate, and I saw this white cloth. And I said, "My goodness," I got through eating and said, "What's that white cloth, Mac?" And they said, "Well, I want to tell you that we have learned that we have lots of concerns that everyone in the party has, not just us, and we're pretty conservative, but these are the last Klan uniforms we're going to make." If you don't think that was a shock.
Well, to be in that room, but then to think that there is change underway, I guess.
Well, there was real change underway.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
These were people who had learned that they had learned to look at issues together and not see those issues as separating them.
If you think about what's going on today, again, the way the anxieties of sort of working class people are used now to drive a wedge between classes and between races, that we sort of they're asked to see their problems as a problem of race or of gender. How different it was back then when you invited people to participate.
Well, and you have to really go out. One interesting thing that is sort of a separate little story is that when when the party wins in power on the OO year, they not only get to redistrict, they get to decide who does the who gets hired to be folks who go out and do the census, the census takers. So we moved to Guilford County at the very time when that was happening in like 1969-70, in December of 69. And in 1970, I went in and I registered and asked to apply to be a census taker, thinking I'd learn the county. So as we were being told, hey, everybody in here is a Republican, and so, you know, we don't hire anyone but Republicans, I raised my hand and said, no, I'm a Democrat. And they said, well, I said, I just registered, and they had not checked that. And so what happened was, instead of getting a town, they gave me a county at Brown Summit and way out. And I went out there and learned everybody and had one woman that had 18 children. And so I came back and I learned that really well. So when I became party chairman, I knew that part of the county. So the Republicans didn't realize they'd really helped me find that part of it.
By pushing out into remote, they thought yeah. they were getting rid of you.
You're right.
Well, so you also came to the attention of Jimmy Carter and gave him some advice, too.
Well, we worked with Carter. You know, we helped. I was involved in his campaign when he was running. And we, again, went over the line to Virginia to help Carter in Virginia at night and to get him the delegates he needed for the convention. And so at the convention in 1976, in 1972, just to tell you this, I had worked with Gloria Steinem and with Jesse Jackson to get the abortion rights plank in the platform. And so I knew a lot of the women nationally, although I was local in North Carolina, and we had formed the National Women's Political Caucus and the North Carolina Women's Political Caucus. And so when I got on the Rules Committee of the Democratic National Committee, and we needed to go ahead and insert in that there would be equal division of women delegates to the national convention. Because in some states, even though you got a delegate, got elected, you get a third of the vote or half of the vote. You didn't get a full vote.
This is 1976.
In 1976, we were back to what it was like for African Americans getting to vote.
Wow.
I mean, you know, if you look at a third of the vote or no vote. And so I introduced that, and I was under the impression that Jimmy Carter was going to support it. Okay. And so I found out the morning after I introduced it that they had changed and he wasn't going to support it. And they actually picked Avril Harriman to debate me on the subject. So I knew I'd lose. So what I've always said is know the rules and know the finances and you're well ahead. And so I knew the rules. So it's probably what Jimmy Carter didn't know is that if I got 34 votes on that committee, it was a minority report and went straight to the floor of the convention. And he'd have to deal with it there. So I had gone around figuring I'd lose, and I got the votes, and it was going to the floor of the convention. And so Governor Carter at the time had to deal with it. And so we had big meetings of women who were really pushing all this. A lot of the names you know, the Bella Abzugs, the Betty Friedans, the Gloria Steinems, and then me as one of the from Greensboro, North Carolina, precinct chairman at that time. And county chair. And so as a result of that, we had to negotiate with Jimmy Carter.
Because the point of this is if he could get it killed silently, it doesn't come to public attention. Once it's on the floor of the convention, he suddenly becomes
battle.
The guy, the Democratic liberal president, liberal for the time, who doesn't want women to have an equal vote. So that's embarrassing for him.
So it was very embarrassing if that were to happen. So he said he would meet with us, and all the women said, okay, who is coming? He said, I don't know. He said, I know Jane Patterson's coming. She had the guts to do this. She'd bring who she wants to, or she can come by herself. And I think about this for women as something for women, going from Guilford County, North Carolina, all the way to negotiating with a presidential candidate because you had the guts to fight for what you thought was right. And so I had to decide who would go with me, so I strategically picked various people, and we asked him for a number of things. And those items we asked him for, if he would commit to that, we would withdraw that in the interest of it being considered at the Memphis mini convention in 1978. And if we elected on that basis, then it would be put in the charter of the party. And he agreed to that. He agreed to every issue we said. And they were really important things, maybe too much to talk about here. But one of them was a percentage of women who would serve in the United States government who had assistant secretary, undersecretary positions. And before that, the highest number had been 3%. And now we were asking for 20-something percent of those positions. And he agreed to that.
And to appoint women as not only in those assistant positions, but also cabinet secretaries. Tell us about that.
Well, the funny thing on cabinet secretary was, he really got us, was the we had somebody, one of the women say, well, what we'd like you to do is appoint a woman to the cabinet. He said, no. And we all went. And he said, well, I'll appoint women to the cabinet. So he got us on that. And he did. And one of our own here in Durham, Secretary Krebs, the Secretary of Commerce, came out of that.
Juanita Krebs, right.
And
Patricia Harris.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I remember that when she was named that day and he named her and he said it was tough to find women for these positions, she turned around and said, Mr. President, it depends on who's doing the looking.
Well said. And how important was it that you were a party chair? When you talk about bringing people into the party and getting them active, the fact that you were a woman and in that position, that had to encourage people to get out.
Oh, it did. And it encouraged women to run for office. You know, in Guilford and across the state, I think, we had more and more women running to be party chair, running to be, you know, it was very much, you know, in the news. I mean, you know, with Cronkite interviewing me and the New York Times writing about it, Glamour writing about it. And so women all across the country, not just North Carolina, knew about that.
My guest is Jane Smith Patterson, a North Carolina native who paved the way for women in politics and technology. We'll talk more about that when our program continues in a moment. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Jane Smith Patterson, who's been working on government policy and technology in North Carolina for more than 40 years. She served in Governor Hunt's cabinet through his four terms, promoting information technology infrastructure around the state. Now works to bring high-speed internet to all parts of North Carolina. Tell us what you did in Jim Hunt's administration.
When Jim Hunt was elected to be governor, not the lieutenant governor, he was the first full-time lieutenant governor in North Carolina. He had three staff people. But when he was elected governor, at the same time Jimmy Hunt was elected president, I mean Jimmy Carter, I was asked by both to go to work for them. And I had two young sons, I was 7 and 9, and no way. And so Jim Hunt said to me, look, Jane, you know, you've always talked about women in positions. It's either put up or shut up time. You need to come to Raleigh. And I said, well, I've got a husband practicing law in Greensboro and a wonderful husband. I mean, and anyway, my husband decided his law firm, he could open another practice in Raleigh. And so I moved with the kids to Raleigh in 1977, and no one was doing that. I mean, it was quite a shock to a lot of my women friends, my close friends. And so I was assistant secretary and then deputy and then secretary of administration. That had all the business side of government. It also had responsibility for purchasing, you know, for information technology, for management, for just enormous amount of things. And I was able to push parity for women within state government and to and minorities both. And I worked hard on both. And that's what women need to know. You can get in positions and then you can push to bring in those who've been basically left out of the system. And Governor Hunt, with the Affirmative Action Program, we set goals. Every cabinet meeting every month, we talked about that. And in order to try to get women and minorities into state government.
Well, and to put a point on it, you've talked about Jimmy Carter and Jim Hunt, both seen as progressive politicians in their own right. And yet, you know, you've given us a few examples of when you as a woman had to be there to push them beyond what was comfortable for them to really get them to the next level.
Well, that's correct. And, you know, I have an oral history of myself over in Chapel Hill. And twice I've had to refuse to allow it to be looked at. I could stop them because some of the people I want to talk about in teaching moments would hurt those people. I don't want to hurt them, but what they did, they would never have done to a man. And that's sitting over there. At some point, they're going to be able in 2030 to look at that and listen to those, what I said about it.
We'll have you back then.
Yeah.
We'll play the tape.
As long as you're here, Frank, I'll be here.
There are some. Oh, I ain't going anywhere. Tell us about. But there are some funny stories. I mean, when you tried to get, for instance, laws. Again, we were talking about 1976 when women only had 1/3 of the vote as Democrats to the convention. So things changed slowly. Women in property rights. That was something you're very instrumental in changing.
Well,
for.
We had a law in North Carolina which said that if basically, here's what it said: that if you were married and you had brought two that marriage property from your family, and it was in the marriage, and you had somehow picked the wrong person to marry, that they were abusive or whatever, and you wanted to leave, well, you could leave, but you would have a problem taking any of that with you until the final settlement was made. And as a consequence, women were trapped in marriages. And we felt it ought to, you know, men could do whatever they wanted to with that. Even they can use the rents, all this stuff the whole time, but you had no access to that. So we decided we needed to change that, and the governor was going to support it. And we lost it on the first vote. And in fact, then the next morning we had about a lot of our men and women friends, young people, went and watched and picked up every single member of the Senate, because we had to get it recalled in the Senate, and followed them, whether they went into restrooms, whether they went in the chapel and hid under the pew, wherever.
They were hiding from you.
We were going to make sure they were in there and voting. And we put women and men on the doors. And I remember one guy came and said, he was from the East, and said, Jane, he said, I need to go to the bathroom. I said, well, ex-senator, I won't call his name. I said, you walked yesterday and you'd promised the governor you'd vote right on this. He said, no, I need to go to the bathroom. I said, he said, what are you going to do, get me a pot? I said, how deep and how wide do you need it?
And you got his vote.
I got his vote.
There were people hiding in the chapel as well.
That's right. They hid under the pew.
That's the ultimate use of sanctuary. But you talked about being Secretary of Administration, which includes business and technology. So what we haven't said through all of this was that what you studied in college when you went was math.
Yeah, but we also had if you think about everything I did, I kept saying the rules and the finance. If you know the rules of the organization and the finances, or you raise the money for it, it puts you in a position as a woman to move quicker, I think, in whatever you want to do, whatever kind of organization. And, you know, I worked very hard on poverty as well. That was one of the issues that I was still interested. The state has too much poverty in it now. And anyone who's listening here, as I said to you earlier, needs to go look at to right these wrongs, which is about the North Carolina Fund and what this state looked like in 1960. It would shock them, I think. And so anyway, to get back to what I liked the most about everything I did was I always was interested in technology. And from the time I graduated from college all the way through, I would always gravitate to the technology issues in an organization. And at Penn, before we came back to Chapel Hill, I worked over at the University of Pennsylvania where the first computer was actually, the ENIAC was established. And after that, we were working on applications to be used in PCs. I actually worked on I had the first LG P30 when I came back to Chapel Hill. It was, you know, like 45 inches long by about 40 across. And I think I had the only one other than the massive system that was over in Phillips Hall.
But this would be what would qualify as a desktop computer.
Yes,
back then,
as a
right?
desktop computer. Computer. And we worked on how to use the computer for applications like Prisoner's Dilemma game, all in rather than just ones and zeros in accounting.
Right.
Or in math.
So
issues.
Problem solving. Can we solve
Very
problems
much.
That are not mathematical?
Right. So this problem is, solving. And so from that, it began, how do I move from to do this to how can I help get involved in working for a company that makes the equipment that will create networks? And that's what I did after, well, first while I was with Jim Hunt, we put in the first digital network of any state in the country for a state network.
This takes all those giant mainframe computers that were at each university, connects them. So they can
and
talk
connects them. And I'll have to say that the companies that work with us were great. Yeah. I mean, Bell South was fantastic working with us on this. And at that time, Carolina Telephone and GTE, all those names that you hear, they really worked with us to make North Carolina lead the country. And they've always done that. We've had a problem later, which I'd like to ask you to ask me about. But we were able to move from the digital technology. When I did that, I left and went to ITT Corporation. And at ITT, they created the first digital switch in the world. And I was very much involved in learning how to proposal engineering, manufacturing, advanced manufacturing, the margin call for the company on every issue. And I also oversaw the contract for the first NATO's digital network of NATO. And so I really got very heavily back into technology, and I loved it.
So you understand not only the technology, but also the business side of it. How can we make a nickel on this?
Ask me the favorite thing I've ever done, it would be my work at ITT, Network Systems Group. It's now what you call Alcatel, okay?
Yeah.
And the reason, It brought my math, my interest in international issues, my ability to speak French, all of this together. And working with people from all over the world, I was their first line woman vice president. I mean, it was just unbelievable. I mean, to be in that, you know, I shouldn't say it that way. If we say in the South, you know, it's like a hog and slop, right?
You don't want to lose that. You don't want to lose that. Whatever else you've done, Jane, yeah. Hang on to that. So here's the thing now. You talked about switching technology. So it's one thing to kind of do a point-to-point communication. I got
right.
One big ENIAC over here and a UNIVAC over there. Now I finally figured out how to wire them together, but they're sort of more or less hardwired. But the switching allows you to bypass
That's
that
right.
UNIVAC to get to somebody else, so I don't have to waste time going
That's
through
right.
those.
And, right? And then we moved when I came back, when Jim Hunt decided that he was running again, which I never thought he would do. And so when he came back into government and called after he got elected, I was down at Wilmington helping Wilmington get reorganized with Jim Lutze, the chancellor. And I had heard when I was at, you know, ITT, I knew there was going to be a change to a whole new technology with the digital switching, and you would need fiber optics rather than copper to give you the most efficient way to use distributive networks. And so Lutze's quid pro quo was, you come here and I'll go with you to Bell South and we'll figure out if we can pilot this. And that's what we did. We piloted that.
At UNC Wilmington.
At UNC Wilmington and in Charlotte. And at that time, I won't go into all that, but it would have cut the cost for Wilmington to communicate with the internet access at NC Wren from $400,000 a year down to $48,000.
Wow.
That's a big difference in what fiber optics right. can do for you and the change bypassing different stations that different companies own. So as a result of that, we proved it would work. And when Jim Hunt ran and got elected again, I asked, can you get the state to move to an ATM Sonnet fiber network across the state? And he said, okay, you know, this is just an upgrade, right, Jane? I said, yeah, it's an upgrade. And so he said, okay, let's do it. And so as a result of that, we were able to create the North Carolina Information Highway yeah. and give us that first fiber across the state. And for the first time, all of our 16 campuses could connect to NC Wren and could be connected to each other. The whole distributive network was brought together. And all of the companies, the private sector companies and the co-ops in North Carolina, the telephone co-ops, worked with us on that. Remember, telephone co-ops, they actually serve from 5 people per root mile to about 12. But they all pitched in. And that's the beauty in North Carolina that I think new people moving to this state need to understand. It's the state has collaborated in times when it's tough to work together to help everyone.
Well, it has in the past. How are things going today?
Things are different today, it seems, in our legislature. And I think that's something that the folks who are in leadership positions in our legislature now from the other party need to understand. In North Carolina, the reason we got the North Carolina Information Highway and the reason we were to get the changes in technology, the reason we got the School of Science and Math started, the reason the Biotech Center was started, the reason that NC Wren, which is a byproduct of the semiconductor start at MCNC, was that all of the former governors, Holzhauser Republican, Martin Republican, Scott Democratic, Sanford Democratic, Hunt, all of them worked together to say, they met in a room and said, we need to make this work. They brought the leadership of the legislature in. That's the North Carolina way. That's what we need to keep in North Carolina, not the what we have now in Raleigh.
Well, now what they're saying now is, yes, we are. Jane, we're with you. We're cutting taxes and we're encouraging even more business to move in here. That's what they'll tell you.
Well, I think the research, and my background is also in research and economic development, the research will show you that that's not accurate. That's exclamation point.
Well, you also said that you wanted me to ask you later if things are working that way now with regard to technology. The universities are all hooked up, but what about the rural areas?
Well, in the rural areas, and I'm no longer in the position of doing North Carolina. I'm actually the chair of Rural Telecom America now, working with all rural states and counties that are rural in the U.S. Now, the program that I was running is now in the Commerce Department. Before, it operated as an authority, and they changed that, and now it's in the Commerce Department. But we have changed in North Carolina. We've gone from when we started working on this from 36% of the households in the state that could get it to 80, I think now it's 82% of households that can get this access to the internet. And so that's a big change. But the problem we have is that companies need to be expanding the bandwidth that's out in the rural areas. Let me give you an example of that. If I'm going down I-85, and everybody knows I-85, they've been building it forever. Okay. If you go down I-85 and you're on the same direction, going the same place, and one lane is running at about 4 megabits, okay, and the lane on your right is running at 10 megabits, that 10 megabit lane is going to get there faster than you are on the 4 megabit lane. And if it's a truck over there running down and you're in a regular car, it's going to carry more information down that or more products down that. And that's the problem for rural North Carolina. In rural North Carolina, they're over there in that lane with the 4 megabits. They're not in that lane with their little car going down there. They're not in that lane with the truck and going 10 megabits. And that's our problem in rural North Carolina.
Is that a price point problem for the providers?
Not necessarily.
Then why don't they do it?
Because I think they haven't yet decided, the companies today haven't decided what business they're in almost, because you have the issue of the content and the issue of who carries the information, and that's the battle on net neutrality. Mm. We now have a wonderful statewide nonprofit network that has connected all the schools and all of the universities together, and most of the libraries. And we can thank both the legislature and particularly Beverly Perdue for really pushing this. It's been a long process over 25 years, but she really stepped in and said, let's get this done in the legislature, in 2008 and so forth, came along and said, let's move it forward. And so we now connect all 2,700 schools to a gigabit network that they could get to gigabit. And gigabit means that truck over there running at 10 megabits. Gigabit's huge, just like having 50 of these highways out there you can ride on.
What would it take to get all those rural communities to realize the potential they have access to?
They realize it. But unfortunately, Wilson, North Carolina, has a gigabit network. But the law was passed by this legislature 2 years ago, H-129, that says local governments, even if they want to do this, are not allowed to do this. Mm. So, that's local control. I thought we were all for local control.
Keep the public out of public policy. Let our private businesses.
So that's a real problem.
Yeah. Well, Jane, what a pleasure talking with you. Well, I wish we had a few more hours, but you're coming back in 2030 when we release the archive of your oral history,
and
we'll talk more.
We'll talk more.
Maybe before then, too. Jane Smith Patterson has devoted her life to politics and technology and women's rights in North Carolina, that and more. And you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. It's a program that's produced by Laura Lee, Nicole Campbell, Megan Modafferi, and Anita Rao. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is our news director. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.